Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to Bantercast, the latest podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. One of the biggest crowds we've had banter over the last couple of months was the one that showed up to hear Blind Boy Boat Club from the Rubber Bandits talk about this, that and the other during the Beach Art Festival in Dunleary. Here's a conversation about art, politics, surreality, Limerick, sex, mental health, fingers, music, religion, health, fashion and other matters with Blind Boy.
Hi folks, welcome along to Banter here at Banter Yard. Would you please give a big rowdy Limerick welcome to Blind Boy Boat Club. I'd say put it on the floor. How are you?
I'm grand. I can't find out that I can't balance a can on that.
I want to start with, I suppose, with a quote of yours. And
you a quote of mine?
Yeah, a quote.
I'm going to start with the quotes first. I'm here for the fashion.
Yeah, no, a quote's always a good way to start, Blind, but a quote's always a good way to start. I think this was from the interview you did with Scroobius Pip, and he said, there's nothing wrong with getting offended as long as a person understands that being offended doesn't make them in the right. We're in an age where everyone seems to be fuming, angry, outraged. You know, I mean, do you really think that this age is going to end well?
It's hard to know. Like, I seen a statistic yesterday. It was in The Guardian, right? And
he means the Nina Guardian, fuckheads.
Do you know the way the world seems like it's gone on fire, like, right now? Like, it's just like, what the fuck is happening? Everything is terrible. And there's this, like, terrorism in the west of Europe is actually at a low, statistically. Do you know what I mean? It was worse in the 70s. Like, in the 70s, fucking aircraft were getting hijacked every week. But it's hard to know, is that, like, is our reality being defined to us because of our access to media? Like, if there was a terrorist attack in the 80s, you actually might find out about it the next day. But now you can go, if you find something's happening out in Paris, you can go onto Twitter and type in Paris, and you're right there now. And it's just hard to know. Is it a kind of a hyper-real level of fear that we're living in, or is it actual?
Yeah.
Is it as bad as we think it is, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Trump is a terrifying man, but at the end of the day, we know that an American president, they don't really have that much power, like, you know? They need the Congress to fucking to sign off on shit, so it's not that scary with Trump. Mm.
It's interesting what you said though, about the media, you know, and like you talked there about, like, reading The Guardian. I find one of the scariest things is the Daily Mail, not the actual Daily Mail itself, but the amount of people who actually retweet, who will, like, I mean, talk up the Daily Mail. And Daily Mail is one horrible, sordid web of shite.
It is, and again, what tends to scare the fuck out of me is not the top half of the internet, but the bottom half of the internet. Particularly in Ireland, you know, the journal.ie, nothing against the journal, they're fine, but the comments underneath the journal can be... No, seriously, do you know what I mean? When I was 10 years ago, I used to look back at... I'd be watching documentaries about World War II, and I'd be going, how the fuck did that happen? How did the people of Germany become complicit with this lunatic? That's mad. That couldn't happen now. But then I read comments underneath the journal.ie. But seriously, do you know what I mean? It's a combination of anger, fear, and misinformation. And, I mean, Freud has this book. I think it's Civilization and its Discontents. Civilization and its Malcontents, it's called. And Freud wrote this in his later life. It was after World War II. And he was trying to get to the psychological kind of roots of how the Holocaust could happen. And Freud reckons that in order for genocide to happen, you need to be able to dehumanize the other group. And as soon as you can dehumanize a group, then it's okay with exterminating them like they're rats. And if you look underneath the journal.ie, you will see a lot of people calling for the extermination of, if it's not Islam, it's travelers, you know? And there's no empathy for them as human beings. It's so easy to... And as well, it happens with arguments between left and right. You'll see some people going, oh, he's a right-winger. And then in your head, you have a vision of what a right-winger is like. A sexually repressed man with a tight shirt who's into Christ a little bit. And then people will have a vision of somebody on the left as an unwashed person who wants to do loads of drugs and sex and everything. But that's not true. You can't polarize any people into a group. You know what I mean?
It's curious as well because, you know, when people read, say, the comments underneath articles, you know, they, like, say, like, the journal.ie or broadsheet.ie or whatever, you know, we all kind of, like, go laughing, go, Jesus, you know, the level of misinformation is there. What I find more scary sometimes, though, like, Blind Boy, is the fact that we accept that these people are out there and where are they getting the misinformation from? And this is something, again, that kind of media seems to have completely fucked up in the last couple of years. This race to the bottom. And because of that, we have created this race of people who are totally misinformed.
To an extent, and it's because journalism is it's not journalism anymore, it's content. Because, you know, true journalism tends not to go viral. Content goes viral, and content is whatever the fuck it causes an emotional reaction in the human, you know? Vice, do you read Vice?
Yeah.
Like, Vice have a very interesting way of going viral. Vice will post an article that says, Nirvana weren't that good as a band. And then I share it because I'm furious. So I'm like, Nirvana were fucking excellent, you cunts. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they believe it or not because I've shared it, you know? And that's content right there. When you say Nirvana weren't that good, you can say that if you like. It's a valid argument, but, you know, you're a bit wrong.
Mm. When yourself and Mr. Cromer worked with Russell Brand on News of Screws and all that was going on, you know, did you get a kind of a reading into celebrity and how mainstream media treats celebrity that kind of opened your eyes a bit?
How do you mean exactly?
I mean, like, in terms of him, like, you know, he's seen as someone who's kind of like, you know, he's a celebrity, he's got like a certain kind of social media following, he's someone that people know, and the way the media kind of like were treating him and kind of reporting on how he was doing.
The thing, he is a very closed individual as a result of that, you know, to the point that, like, Russell Brand liked one of our videos, then he emailed us and I got chatting to him and got friendly with him, right? And then when he was shooting The Trues, right? So he was living in Hackney at the time, which is hipster central. And he needed a cameraman for The Trues. And he emailed me in Limerick to see if I knew anybody who could get him a cameraman. That's because he couldn't trust fucking anyone. Do you know what I mean? His amount of people that he felt that he could trust was so small that in order, like, if you spit on the ground in Hackney, you're going to spit on a cameraman as a given. And he needed to email fucking Limerick to get a cameraman in Hackney. So he himself is very, now, at the moment now he's living in a woods. He's living in the woods in England trying to conceive a child, which I believe he has done. But, like, yeah, it's madness. I mean, even for us, like, I mean, you attach your celebrities. There was a time there when we were releasing songs and the only way one of our songs would get into the media is if somebody like Russell Brand or Darrow O'Brien said they liked it. You know, the music would never get into the media for the sake of it. It needed to be attached to a celebrity's name in order for that to go viral.
Yeah. Do you think, though, like, I mean, it's curious you said it. I was down in Limerick a few weeks ago at the Make a Move Festival and I came across some, like, amazing stuff down there, you know. So, like, you know, there's a really strong scene down there. And it kind of struck me that scene that's down there, that scene, I suppose you were kind of part of in many ways and parented in many ways back in the day, that scene exists without the mainstream media whatsoever, Blind Boy. And, like, they rely on social, they rely on kind of, like, I suppose, word of mouth, they rely on their own social networks to get out there. That's as valuable as anything else, isn't it?
It's as valuable as anything, but I mean, I'd imagine the Make a Move Festival, it's a Limerick hip-hop festival, if you don't know. It's, you know, they'd be happy to break even with that festival. But that's what you get, you know, from that type of carry-on.
Mm, okay. I wanna
Why is that funny? That type of guy, that's just me talking.
So let's move on to something else you did this year, the start of the year, that 1916 documentary. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm curious about your take on 1916, you know, now looking back. And it struck me that, like, we did an awful lot of kind of plumbing and slapping each other on the back about what the boys in 1916 did. We did that back in April. It's now kind of like July, and we've kind of forgotten about them, you know? That, like, I mean, it shows the kind of, like, new attention span. Did you feel that after that documentary came out, that the way people reacted to it was interesting?
It was. I mean, mainly, yeah, it was grand. I mean, my own grandfather was in Tom Barry's flying column down in Cork. And my grandfather and my granduncle and my two granduncles. So I grew up here in Notton, but the old IRA. And there's one scene in that documentary where we get to dress up as Tom Barry's flying column. And that's kind of the reason I did it. It's like, I want to dress up as my granddad on TV, you know? I mean, for me, I like 1916 because it's those lads that were doing 1916, they were in their 20s and 30s. And I was just going, fucking hell, look at the shit that they were up to, you know what I mean? Mm. And just kind of trying to put it into perspective to now. And 1916 globally is a very important year because it was kind of when empires were dissolving, do you know, and we had what we now call the modern capitalism. And aside from 1916 in Ireland, another very important thing happened, which was the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Are you familiar with that? Sykes-Picot Agreement is an agreement between France and Britain to carve up the Middle East into the territories that we now know as the countries of the Middle East in the interests of French and British oil, which then went into the hands of the Yanks after World War II. And all this shit that we're dealing with today with fucking ISIS and all that carry on, it's because of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It's one major thing that happened in 1916. I've had several cans, man. I don't know if I'm rambling.
Do you want another one? Just some water.
I'm grand for water, man.
Okay, grand.
Like, I'm not pissed. Like, I'm in a Sykes-Picot frame of mind.
But that's curious because that's a good point to kind of like dive into something. Then, so what do you think?
It was relevant. It was 1916. Like, I mean,
1916 was a great year. But what would a revolution look like in 2016? An Irish revolution look like in 2016? A
lot of taxi drivers with bowl-cut jeans and fucking. It would, like, because that's what I was thinking. I was like, if fucking 1916 happened tomorrow, who'd do it? It'd be the Dublin taxi drivers going up to Google with a couple of pistols and some wearing flares with shiny black shoes. That would be, you know, it would, like.
That's a great image. But, like, I mean, joking aside, is that because they're the only ones left in any kind of bottle?
I don't know why I think, I just kind of, the lads who got involved in 1916, the leaders were, and this is what pisses me off a little bit about 1916, the leaders were teachers and lawyers and artists and all this stuff, but the participants were the people who lived in the fucking tenements. And they were James Connolly's citizen army who had been locked out of Dublin in the Dublin lockouts in 1913. And the kind of post-independence narrative of Ireland tends to remember very much the kind of the middle class. Fucking the teacher, the painter, the lawyer, it remembers them, but it tends not to remember the lads in the tenements. And I think that was a post-Devil era narrative that sends a message to Ireland that if you want to have a revolution and you want to put a gun in your hand, it's grand if you're a teacher, but it's not grand if you live in a slum. That's dangerous. I think that was the crack. And it's been kind of rewritten in that way because you don't really, there was a lot of people involved in 1916. They weren't all painters. There was about, you know, 10 of them who were fucking, do you know what I mean?
But like, you know, I also kind of wonder as well, given the fact that we spent so much time this year talking about 1916, do you reckon like we're going to spend as much time in the next couple of years talking about like what happened from 1919 onwards when Dan Breen and Sean Tracy and the lads went to Solihull and blew up a load of policemen?
You see, this is the thing. It depends where ISIS are going, you know? This is what makes 1916 difficult, is that at the end of the day, Padraig Pearse was blood sacrifice, you know? He was a jihadi, whether you like it or not. That's what he fucking was, you know? And you get closer to 1922, and there is... It's a tough one, right? Yes, Irish Catholics were oppressed, but it wasn't necessarily because of their faith. It was just because they were oppressed because of their faith. And we're going to have to celebrate something in 1922, you know?
Yeah.
You can't just pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah. Moving on to the other thing, which is like, it was getting that in that Scroobius paper interview you did, or was it maybe Brezzy? I can't remember which one it was. But you started talking about that song.
I don't remember. Did I do an interview with Brezzy?
You did a great interview with Brezzy. Oh, yeah. Jeez, yeah, it was great, you know? Yeah. You've been interviewed by all the superstars.
I had pints with him, like, I can't remember.
Or maybe he just taped the pints then, you know. And you were talking about that song you've got the Up the Ra, you know,
yeah.
and the way that's supposed to take on a life of its own, you know. I mean, like looking at that through the kind of, I suppose, lens of 1916, 2016, how do you regard?
Well, Up the Ra, like, all right, are you familiar with our song Up the Ra? Yeah. Well, I wrote Up the Ra like fucking nearly 10 years ago, right? And it was my relationship with republicanism as a 16-year-old. I wasn't too interested in school, So I'd be at the back, very interested in Tupac, very interested in Bob Marley, hugely interested, but not that interested in what the teacher is saying. So the teacher would be talking about, oh yeah, James Connolly was mad, he was a mad cunt, and all of, and De Valera was brilliant, but it would filter into my head as these things, oh, and then they rub shit on the wall, and then all of this. But it got tied up in my head with the mythology of Tupac and Bob Marley. So I just put it into a song. But now that I'm older and I have the ability to critically analyze, and also the fact that when you're in school, you just want to rebel against the teachers, so you don't want to learn. But as soon as you get out of school, you go, fucking hell, I had access to a lot of brilliant shit in school and I didn't bother. So now that I'm older, I'm like, yeah, I want to learn about 1916. I want to learn about all that stuff.
It's curious about, like, you know, the way you kind of tied up the Ra and kind of Tupac in your head, you know, and like in many ways, you know.
But that's how it was in Limerick. That's how it was growing up. It's like you would write on the wall up the Ra and then write Bob Marley or UB40 afterwards. But that's the way it was. You know, these were the heroes. You had Tupac was a hero. Bob Marley was a hero. You didn't really know. Tupac got shot. Bob Marley wanted free hash. And the Ra made Irish people look cool. That was it. And you wrote that on the wall. So that's what that song was about. Yeah, that kind of misinformation.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like, you know, with the Ra, you know, there's all the plaques around the country of what they did. On the Tala bypass, there's a kind of a shrine to Tupac. I don't know if you know about this.
I haven't seen that.
You should go and have a look at this, Blind Boy. There's an actual shrine to Tupac. It's one of the few places outside of LA you'd ever get a shrine to Tupac, you know. And it's interesting the way you've kind of mixed them all up in your head. Like, I mean, we have this interesting kind of relationship with the rebel class.
Here's the thing as well. When I remember when rap music wasn't cool. When I was a kid, before Eminem came along, rap music wasn't cool. If you listened to rap music, you were seen as a freak. Then Eminem came along in 2002. He came out in 98, but when he went popular in Ireland was 2002. Then it was okay to listen to rap. But before Eminem, you were a freak, with the exception, for some reason, of Tupac, because Tupac got shot. So you were allowed to listen to Tupac as the only rap. But outside of that, if you listened to rap, you were as good as a metaler.
What got you into hip-hop in the first place down in Limerick?
What do I think of what?
What got you into hip-hop in the first place down in Limerick?
I was 9 years of age, and I had a brother. I have all older brothers, and they were huge into Bob Dylan, right? And one of my brothers read an interview that there's a fella called Ice-T, and whatever pundit in the magazine said that Ice-T is the modern-day Bob Dylan. So my brother went into HMV and found an Ice-T tape for £3, listened to it, this is a piece of shit, gave it to me when I was 9, and I got fucking hooked on it from then on. So I was in a little enclave with myself, listening to hip-hop in Limerick, listening to Ice-T, and then I had a buddy from America, and he brought over Wu-Tang Clan, which you couldn't even get in Limerick, and I just kind of developed that, and then I had my first experience of hipster rage when rap became popular around 2002. I was furious that other people were listening to it, because that was my thing, you know. But it my three things when I was Ice-T, Ice Cube, Cypress Hill, of course. I used to grow hash when I was a child. Not because I wanted to smoke it, because Cypress Hill told me to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I just wanted to hit, because you couldn't get weed in Limerick. You could not get weed. When the IRA were around, you could only get hash. Weed is a Celtic Tiger thing. When people... It fucking is. That's it. Everything is weed now. There's no such thing as soap bar hash or smelly sock, as we used to call it. It's gone. Who remembers smelly sock? If you get hash now, it's actually good.
Okay. I'm curious about, like, when yourself and Chrome decided to, like, I mean, start writing tracks and releasing songs in the first place, you know? I mean, where was your head at? Were you looking to emulate people like Ice-T and Ice Cube?
Well, we started off, like, we were in school. He was a year ahead of me, but he did transition year. And then we both met up in fifth year in fucking art class. And we were both messing. And we both had the same type of messing. And then we became friends. And then I started doing impressions of teachers and people that we knew. And then our friend Dara Durkin said, "That's really funny, you should record that." So then we recorded it. And then I started doing prank phone calls that I made for like 10 of my friends in a class. And then we made that. And then we were going, well, yeah, that's really funny, but they'd never get it in the class next door. So then people started copying it in the class next door, and then it started going viral all over Limerick. Before viral was a thing, it was only CDs. So then, a couple of years later, when we were in our early 20s, I picked up a copy of Fruity Loops, which is a music production software, when I was a young fella. And I'd been making beats. And then we said, let's do a song for the crack. And we did, and that was Bag of Glue. Yeah. And then we became famous.
I mean, like Limerick has obviously informed so much of what you've done, you know? Limerick's a surreal...
100%.
Limerick's a surreal fucking place.
I mean, that's what I love about Limerick. It's people see Limerick as a kind of a violent place. It's not. Limerick is a surreal place. I grew up, right, with the reality of, don't go near Arthur's Quay Shopping Centre. Why not? Yeah. Because there's a crow on the roof who'll steal fags out of your mouth. And it's fucking true. And this crow was fucking 15 years ago, right? 15 years ago, this crow was here robbing fags out of your mouth. If you smoked a fag near Arthur's Quay Shopping Centre, this crow was coming down taking that fag. Simple as that. There's no way he's still alive. You still can't smoke a fag outside Arthur's Quay because of this crow. And it killed me for ages. I was going, what's the story with this crow in Limerick who robs fags? And then I went and did a bit of research. It turns out that certain crows and certain magpies as well will steal cigarettes that have been lit and then line their nests with a fucking smoked fag because it keeps parasites out of the nest. So that's Limerick for me, a fucking crow robbing your fag. But like, and you've got the spire up here, whatever.
Do you reckon that crow will be into vaping?
I don't know. I like this. It's pure Blade Runner, you know? I have to get off the fags, man. They kill you.
Okay, good. Let's stick with Limerick for a while. Was there, like, when the Rubber Bandits came out, you know, when all the shit, when all the kind of good shit happened, you know, when you, like, people were talking about you, when Ryan
Torberty... The horse.
Yeah, the horse. No, we leave the horse for a minute. But, like, you know, when Ryan Torberty was known about you and Joe Duffy was known about you, at the same time, there was a kind of, like, there was another narrative going on about Limerick. You know, there was, like, the violence, the kind of, like, the gangland shit that was going on, contained to a couple of the streets with a couple of head the balls. Do you think, you know, the Rubber Bandits thing was, like, a kind of, almost like a hyper-reality version? Like, I mean, Limerick
no,
something
absolutely.
Else.
That was the intention, because when we started doing it on a larger scale, we both went off getting a kind of an artistic education, and we both learned about Baudrillard and hyperrealism and things like that. So from the start, our intention was, if the media is we would get up in the morning and read something in the paper about Limerick, such as shooting in Limerick, entire community living in fear, locking up doors, and it's like, this is incorrect. Yes, there was a shooting in Limerick. Unfortunate members of the community are affected, but the entire city is not affected. We wanted to take the view of Limerick that was being portrayed by the media and then sell that back to the people as a hyper-real version of it, mixed up with a kind of a Flann-O'Brien madness, so that it just becomes incomprehensibly mental with a little bit of violence in there and throw in a bit of Tupac and Gerry Adams for the crack.
But do you think it worked?
I suppose so, yeah. I'm going to tell you our next thing that we're doing. I'm not supposed to say it. We're after getting a series with MTV USA. You're not recording that, eh? It's not announced yet.
It's on Twitter.
So, don't put it on Twitter. Do you know the Impossible Game Show that we did with... The Yanks are after taking that, so at the moment we're doing Impossible Game Show for MTV USA.
Fucking great.
But that's, like, it's grand, like, but I think of it as, we started off as a pair of teenagers making prank phone calls, and all anybody said to us was, they'll never get that in the next classroom. And then they said, they'll never get that in the other school. And then it was like, they'll never get that in Limerick, they'll never get that in Dublin, they'll never get that in England. And now it's MTV USA, so yeah. Fuck the begrudgers.
Yeah. The other thing at the last Wild Blind Boy was, like, you know, that you went back to LIT and you got your MA.
I got a master's for the crack,
you know.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say it was for the crack now, you know what I mean?
I actually did it for the crack, yeah. No, honest to fuck. I was getting tired of... my job was the Rubber Bandits and writing and writing and writing. And it started to become the anti-crack, right? So I figured, I need something to actually stress me out. So I went and did a master's degree, and that became very stressful, and then I was able to create better at the Rubber Bandits. But it was good. I got to, you know, outline some of the theoretical underpinnings of gas cuntism.
Give us an example of some of them were.
I did a 30,000 thesis on internet memes. 30,000 words on internet memes and lolcats and trollface. And I did that for 30,000 words. And what I did was internet memes as a device for social change. And I did that for 30,000 words. That's not a sentence in the English language, is it? I did it for 30,000 words. But when you look at the way the world is, I would blame, not blame Brexit, but I think the likes of Britain First memes, they a lot of responsibility for what happened with Brexit is because of shit like that. Yeah. With a meme, you can get out a very small amount of sensationalist information very quickly. And if that information is negative, you can end up with Brexit. Killing us, boys, will you? I'm half cut. I can't be dealing with cunts talking in the corner as well.
You mentioned Brexit there. Are you still based over London? Are you back here?
We're based in Malta, man. That's it's the only place to base yourself. No, I'm based in Limerick.
But looking at that Brexit thing, you know, looking at the fact that, like, I mean, you know, the way people were aghast when Britain voted to kind of go, you know, do you think, you know, it's a bit more than just internet memes? Do you think, like, I mean, someone like Britain as well, you know, going back to, I suppose, the 800 years of oppression, going back to 1916, that this is just, like, you know, another iteration in Britain's kind of, like, stupid, poxy cuntism?
In a way, yes. It's the British people are... They have an arrogance about them because they owned most of the world. So they didn't want the pound, or they didn't want the euro, first of all. And they can't see themselves as needing to rely upon any other economic civilization. They just can't see it. I think Brexit could be brilliant for Ireland, because all of these corporations that are in London, they might come over to Ireland, and as you know, it could fuck off rent for a couple of people, but jobs are jobs, like.
Yeah. That's a tier yourself and Dave McWilliams have in common.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm not going to say anything unless McWilliams okays it first, because I know nothing about economics. And the other person is Eddie Hobbs, and I'm not listening to him.
Yeah, we leave Eddie alone.
He's
leave
from
Eddie
Cork. They're all beekeepers down there.
Beekeepers?
Yeah. They're mad into bees in Cork. The only place left in Ireland that has bees is Cork. I haven't been stung by a bee or a wasp all summer, but you go down to Cork and I got stung by a wasp. And they're just bees with hats on.
Let's kind of go back to your appearance on the Late Show earlier on this year, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of people whose opinion of you and the Rubber Band has changed completely as a result of that. They saw a much different side to you. Do you think, you know, that many people have a completely different take on the Rubber Band now? The fact is, you mentioned the horse. The horse was always kind of like part of the narrative around the band, around what Joseph and Chrome did. You know, now it's something totally different. The people are slowly getting their heads around the fact that, like, I mean, this is a different kettle of fish.
We always kind of had that in the music. It just wasn't as blatant. But like with Horse Outside, we tried to distance ourselves from it as quickly as possible because we became the cursing Jedward. And nobody wants that. But like with the Topperty thing, I had one thing, right? When I went on The Late Late, I said to myself, I can't go on to The Late Late and not say something that isn't properly covered in the press. And I was heralded as like, oh, he's talking the truth, and he's... All I did was talk what the reality of all my friends in Limerick. That's it. In Limerick, the fact of the matter is that people need to patrol the rivers. Yeah. Genuinely, you go out for a pint in Limerick at 4 a.m. Did you say finish up? You can't hear... Oh, sorry. Are there cunts out there listening? Oh, sorry, I didn't know that. But... I'm glad that you volumed me up as I got to my most depressing bit. But the reality is, in Limerick, and I haven't seen much of it around Ireland, if you go out for a pint in Limerick at like 5 a.m, right? If you even look into the river, a person will come over to you wearing a fluorescent jacket and ask you, how are you getting on? We've got a volunteer suicide patrol in Limerick because it's so bad down there. And this is the reality of what everybody has to live with in Limerick at the moment. And when I went on The Late Late, the other problem as well is Ivan Yates was sitting beside me, right? And he was clearly just talking the shit that Fine Gael want people to hear. and I had to subvert the words that he was saying with a little bit of reality. Yeah. But the words that I said, they weren't mine. They were the words that I'm listening to every fucking single one of my friends saying. That's the truth. You either fuck off to America or fuck off to Australia or hop into a river. That's it. That's the way it is down in Limerick. It's getting a little bit better at the moment. The end is a recovery is a slightly more evident. It's a bit of a blow that we didn't get the 2020 City of Culture thing. But it's you know, it's a little bit better. But the other thing as well is the summer months. Suicide gets a little less worse in the summer because it's just it's positive. The fucking sun is shining. But as soon as November happens, then the patrols need to be out again. You know.
Yeah. Like no, that reality that of those volunteer suicide patrols. It happens in other places as well, but not as much in Limerick. You know.
And I don't know. Is it because of the? There's an old thing in Limerick because we had the same problem as well in the 70s. And I was talking to an old fella, and what they used to say in the 70s is that there's something about water. That if you're in a bad place, the water kind of calls you. It asks you towards it, you know? Which I think there's two things that call human beings, and that's water and fire. There's a theory of human evolution that for hundreds and thousands of years, right, humans did fuck all until we discovered fire. And they don't know, is it because fire allowed us to burn meat and release extra proteins into our brain, or did the manipulation of fire allow us the contemplative space whereby we could generate ideas? Because you know when you look into a fire, you get fucking lost like a daydream. They say that was a crucial part of human evolution. But water is the same. Water will lull you into a situation where you're looking at it. And you can't look at water and not be introspective. It's what it does. And fire is the exact same thing. So that's the kind of the dichotomy of Limerick.
Yeah.
Are we fucked economically? Or is there such a huge heaving river that it causes people to make silly decisions?
Jim Kimmy used to always say that, like, apparently that nothing good came out of Shannon. Like, I mean, it draws you in, and like, you know, Kevin Barry uses that line in Bahan as well. The fact that, like, you know, there's something bad coming off the river all the time. That, like, I mean, there is.
And
that
Frank McGort said there's a dampness that rises from it. I love the river because I actively work on my mental health every day. I meditate beside the river in Limerick. Because I see it as a source of life. But if you're in a bad place and you don't have access to mental health services, or you don't even have access to somebody to tell you about decent emotional intelligence, I can see how that river could draw you in. But what breaks my heart about the fucking suicide in Limerick is because I got talking to some of these the lads that were patrolling the rivers. The nights that they have to be watching are, we'll say, student nights when everybody gets pissed. Most of the people that end their lives in Limerick are doing so because they're pissed. And we all make stupid decisions when we're pissed. But they're making a decision that there's no fucking return from.
I mean, the other thing that you did this year was you did a work with kind of Pieta House, and you talked quite openly about your own mental health.
You know?
I mean, do you kind of think that the way people are, we mentioned Brezzy earlier on, he's someone else who's kind of come out, that like suddenly people are talking an awful lot more about things that we never used to talk about before. There's an openness there. You know, it's definitely changed the way we look at kind of mental health, and definitely changed the fact that people realize other people are going through the same shit.
I personally believe that is because of the church and confession boxes. With confession boxes, you had a culture in Ireland whereby you go into a very private space, you tell the priest what you did wrong, and then he gives you penance. But that penance doesn't cause you to reflect upon your actions. So it's like a really shit counselling. But that's, you know, that's the culture we had in Ireland for fucking years. But if you go to a decent counsellor, you go and tell them the stuff you did, and the two things they tell you is, first of all, forgiving yourself, and second of all, taking responsibility for your actions. 50 Hail Marys have nothing to do with taking responsibility and have nothing to do with self-forgiveness. It has to do with psychologically flagellating yourself. Yeah. The Iona boys hate me for that stuff.
You also did a kind of like a call out for Pieta House. Are you glad you didn't do something for Console?
I'm fucking relieved I didn't do anything for Console because they were on to me. But
were they on to you, yeah?
They were. A lot of them were. The reason I chose Pieta is that I just had a look into it, and it appears to be The structure of it is sound and it's very simple. If you can raise 1,000 quid for a Pieta house, that will provide 12 sessions of counselling for anyone who needs it. And I know myself from my own journey. When I was a young fella, I'd awful agoraphobia and anxiety, and as a result of that, then you end up with depression, because if anxiety is your thing, and we'll say, for me, if I got a panic attack in Dunn's, right, I would then not be able to go back to Dunn's, because in my mind I would associate a panic attack with being in Dunn's, so Dunn's became a no-go area. Then what happens is that you feel a sense of shame because you're like, oh, fuck it, I can't even go to Dunn's. I'm such a loser. That then results in depression. So the whole thing feeds into itself. That's how it all works. I got out of that because I was lucky enough. When I went to college. When I was in college, I had access to a few sessions of counselling, and the counsellor said there's this thing called cognitive behavioural therapy. I went and got a cognitive behavioural therapy book. It opened up fucking everything for me. So now on a daily basis, I use cognitive behavioral therapy to adjust how I look at situations, how I look at myself and how I look at other people. And I'm anxiety and depression free for a year, for 10 years with no fucking medication. And what I want to be cautious about in that statement is that I'm not isolating people who have genuine mental illness. There's a difference between mental health issues and mental illness. Mental illness is when somebody has schizophrenia, when somebody has fucking borderline personality disorder, or what's that one where you obsess over things?
OCD.
OCD, which is a real disorder. But most of us, we don't have that. Most of us are just a little bit sad a lot of the time, or a little bit anxious all of the time. The thing about life is like a back garden. I wish the fucking Forrest Gump would have been fucked up if they put that. But no, really though. Life is like a back garden, right? And with your back garden, you've got a lawn. And if your back garden, most of us, our back garden is in shit. There's lawnmowers there, there's washing machines there, all of that shit. We can remove the washing machines and the lawnmowers. We can take all that shit away so that you're just left with a lawn. And the thing about that lawn is that the lawn will exist and always be there, but it's going to have rainy days where it's just mud, and then it'll have sunny days. But human discomfort, 90% of the shit that really, really bothers us is completely and utterly avoidable. We're either worrying about shit that has happened before or shit that's going to happen. That's not real. There's no point worrying over something that's happened before. You need to forgive yourself. And there's no point worrying about something that may happen in the future. So a lot of our upset, whether it be anxiety or depression, is totally within our control. If you can get down to the base level where you're just dealing with a lawn, then that means that some days it's going to rain, some days it's going to be sunshine, but I can cope. But we don't need fucking washing machines and mattresses on top of it. But that's what we're doing every day. We've got fucking washing machines and mattresses and the fucking neighbour getting sick into it. We do. And we can get rid of that very easily by a kind of a simple mantra, which is that you have no control over what happens to you in this life. What you have one fucking 100% control over is the attitude that you have towards what happens. Mm. And that's what causes human discomfort. My friend Bono, not the Bono. My friend Bono from Limerick, who gigs with us occasionally as Willie O'DJ. Bono loves Manchester United with all his heart. When Manchester United lose, Bono actually goes into depression. I don't give a fuck about Manchester United. I don't give a fuck about soccer. So when Manchester United lose, I don't give a shit. These are two different people, myself and Bono. One of us gets depression, one of us doesn't. What is the variable there? We both, our attitudes towards Man United losing are different. Therefore, Man United losing is not cannot cause depression. Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Because you can change Man United and all of a sudden that becomes your nose. Or all of a sudden that becomes your job. If you feel my job isn't good enough, everyone judges me. It's fucking harsh shit. Nobody judges you because everyone's too busy worrying about themselves. We can control all of this shit. Our back gardens are fucked. clear all the shit out of it and just deal with a lawn. And this lawn is going to be muddy some days and it's going to be sunny other days. You'll be grand, you'll cope.
Last couple of questions for you. I want to let you back out to enjoy the rest of the festival. Last couple of questions.
Thank you.
Aside from taking the Yanks for their money with MTV, what are the next plans?
They're not even paying me that much, the cunts.
What's this documentary you're working on with for RTE?
No, that's the one, yeah. So I'm doing the Yankee thing because it pays my wage for the year. And that's fine, and it's good crack. But then I'm doing a four-part documentary with RTE about the human condition. It went into the papers recently because they were like, oh, the rubber bandits want to fuck each other on television. Did you see that? So the Sunday World or whoever did a story that we want to have sex on RTE. This is the story with fucking RTE, right? RTE are a very conservative organization. So if you're a writer of comedy or whatever and you're dealing with a conservative organization, go to them with the most terrifying piece of information first. So go to RTE and say, we want men and women fucking on television. What are you going to do about it? Freak the shit out of them, and then all of a sudden, the idea about Eamon de Valera wearing a virtual reality helmet in a Magdalen laundry, all of a sudden, isn't that shocking? So we have a policy within our writing process of active disinformation to RTE. So we told them, we want to record a fuck fest, lads. We want loads of men and women fucking each other up the arse. And it freaked them out. But then the papers got a hold of it. We're not doing sex things on RTE. We're doing an episode on sex because sex is an important part of the human condition. But I don't want people fucking on it because they're not going to show it anyway. Yeah. Yeah. We'll do it with a bit of integrity and critical analysis. Yeah.
So besides Dev exploring the Magdalen laundries, what else can we expect from this?
I had one idea regarding that Magdalen Laundry thing. I had an idea that it was rejected by RTE, obviously, about a thing called Christianity 2.0, where a man puts on a virtual reality headset and he witnesses the rape of the Virgin Mary from the point of view of God. Look.
RTE said no to that.
All I'm saying, look, how else are you going to do Immaculate Conception? She did not give consent. So, and he must have done it, so what did it look like from his point of view? I know it hurts us inside to think of that, but that's what you gotta go with. So RTE didn't like that idea.
But what ideas did RTE actually like, Blind Boy?
We're very subtly just dripping them out to them. And the way you do it is you drip it out at the last minute, and it's too close to filming for them to say no. That's how we did it. Look, with the 1916 thing, we dressed up as black and tans outside the GPO and read out the proclamation. The only way to do that is to leak it to them so far that it's actually already shot. And their response to that was to put it on at 12 a.m. on New Year's Eve when nobody's at home. But I'm happy to do that. I like that relationship. It makes me feel like Don Conroy when he used to get his tits out.
On that brilliant note, please, Blind Boy, both up.
Thank you. And thank you. Thank you for having me, lads.
Many thanks to Blind Boy for taking the time to join us at Banter and to Erica Bridgman from Body Tonic for helping make this one happen. This podcast was recorded by Dylan Higgins and produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter. Plus, you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another Bantercast. Until then, goodbye and take care.